way you kill zombies, you probably know this from the movies, right? Is you shoot them in the head, which is also the way you kill anyone. So I'm talking about this with Jen, and she laughs, and I laugh, and we laugh as one. And then she says, but if we had a baby, I think it would be different. And I was like, ch-ch. You got bit!
Comedian Mike Birbiglia becomes a father and joins the zombies. It's The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. On today's show, we have a very special episode with a comedian I have loved for a very long time, Mike Birbiglia. We met backstage at the Amundsen Theater in downtown LA, where he has been performing his latest show. It's called The New One. Today, The New One premiered on Netflix, and in my opinion, is some of the most hilarious and moving work he's done in his career. His other one-man shows include Sleepwalk With Me, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, and Thank God for Jokes. You might also know Mike from his many appearances on This American Life and one of my favorite movies of the past few years, Don't Think Twice, which he also directed. The New One is all about Mike's indecision about becoming a parent and the unexpectedly hard road it took to get there. Spoiler alert, he and his wife Jen, or Chloe as he affectionately calls her on stage, now have a 4-year-old daughter named Una. Before he went on for one of his final LA performances this past weekend, Mike opened up about his unique process putting The New One together and broke down his evolution from stand-up to theater and why he doesn't care how anyone wants to characterize what he does. We also discussed our mutual, unhealthy obsession with Saturday Night Live. It was a great talk that I cannot wait for you all to hear. But first, if you're enjoying this show, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want to know which episodes you've enjoyed the most and who you want to hear on the show next. Oh, and also check out @LastLaughPod on Instagram to see behind-the-scenes photos from this episode and others. Now, let's listen to my interview with Mike Birbiglia. So thanks for having us in your dressing room.
Yeah. Been here for 5 weeks.
Yeah, how's it feel? You're almost done with
four more shows.
LA run.
Yeah, 4 more shows. I did 39 here. 99 on Broadway, and then all told probably like close to 500 performances of this show.
Wow.
And this is it. And I think that's why I'm sick, of course. You know, my body is just like, all right, we're done.
Yeah.
And then
and then it goes on Netflix on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And then that's it. You'll never perform this one again.
I don't know. I think I might actually, but I don't know when. Maybe in a few years.
Yeah.
There's something about this show that's unlike any other show that I've done where I feel like the audience is, there's something they're getting from it that feels like it's like they need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
no,
for,
I totally
for
get
parents,
that.
Like for parents, there's something about it. Like, you know, mothers and fathers come up to me and they're just like, oh, that we're more comfortable talking about this thing and elephant in the room kind of like topic. And
yeah,
so that's been,
I think, for parents or people who are considering being parents.
Yeah, sure. I have some people come up and they go, oh, okay, so I'm definitely never gonna have a kid, you know. And then some people go I think I'm gonna have a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, I think all those reactions are good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I got to see the show about a year and a half ago in New York when you were doing it downtown.
Yeah.
Which was great. And then I saw it a couple of weeks ago here.
Oh, cool.
So it was fun to see. I mean, I'm not sure how much changed in
it's
that time.
It's actually changed quite a bit.
But it was, you know, it was interesting to kind of see what the differences were, how it evolves over that time. Because I think when I saw it the first time, it was towards the beginning of when you were doing this show.
Sure.
And now it's towards the end. I was also curious about how you keep it fresh for yourself after doing so many performances. I mean, when I came here, you know, I think maybe there were some people coming in late and you comment on that. You
yeah.
kind of, it seems like you try to do something at the top of the show that is different or...
Usually the first 30 seconds or so is something off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Is that just sort of to kind of make sure that you're present,
yeah,
you think?
Yeah. Something like that, yeah. And to make sure everyone realizes that, like, it's me, I'm there, I put the microphone on, you know, as opposed to, like, walking out with it on already. And, excuse me. And, And then I try to keep an open mind to like wherever things go. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone's phone goes off, I'll acknowledge it. And basically, I'll acknowledge anything that feels like it's occurring in the room. If there's someone has a crazy, absurd laugh, I'll mention that. Yeah. If they, you know, if any, the other night there was a guy with a shiny coat.
Yeah.
It was bright, bright coat. I go, how come it's so shiny in the front row? He goes, it's a cycling coat. And I go, okay. And then I go, you shouldn't wear that here. And then I mentioned it like four or five times in the show. And then it became a thing. And then this woman came up to me afterwards when I was signing posters in the lobby. And she goes, so is there someone with a cycling coat every night? And no. No.
Yeah.
And then she goes, but so then what do you do?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Something else.
You know, something else. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Good answer. Something else.
Yeah. I mean, when I first saw the show, it was interesting to see it twice because when I first saw the show, I didn't know whether you ended up having a kid or not.
Mm.
And I know that you've kind of wanted to, you like that that's a secret for people in a sense, although maybe it's gotten harder with all of the
press. Yeah. It's probably harder at now. Yeah.
But is that something that you thought about when you were putting it together that you didn't want people to know?
Well, it's funny because for subscription series here, they don't know,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they don't know who I am.
Yeah, so they haven't maybe read what other people have read or listened to podcasts.
For them, it is sort of a true mm-hmm. surprise. I sort of like that it's a surprise, but it's a hard. I mean, in the internet age, it's very hard to have any secrets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to watch trailers for movies.
I like to just go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was also, so I mean, this is the Broadway audience here, and this was the first show that you did on Broadway as opposed to off Broadway, right?
Yeah. This is my fourth solo show off Broadway. And then this is the one that ended up going to Broadway. And I think, honestly, like, I think my audience just is my age.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just like,
they grew up a little bit.
They started going to Broadway shows. I don't fall for these cliches at weddings where they'll say like two becomes one. But I do feel like if you're lucky in a relationship, there are moments. And I mean moments. Like this is a moment. That was a moment. There are moments where you feel like your souls are colliding in a way that two souls have never collided in the history of humankind, and you think, how did I get this lucky? My wife and I hate going to parties, but we love driving away from parties.
And then the Netflix version you filmed on Broadway, is that right?
And that's a community too. I get together with all those guys.
All the Netflix guys?
All the Netflix comedians. We have a brunch every year. It's me and Chelsea Handler.
Yeah.
And Dave Chappelle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Kyle Kinane. It's the four of us.
It's a good group. but it, I mean, it's fun to have it on Netflix.
It's great. It's great. Particularly because of the international reach of it, because I have a daughter, like it's very hard for me to go to Australia and, mm-hmm. and other places, you know, in Europe and stuff like that, because I don't want to be away from her
right.
too long.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to send them a version of it and Seth Barish, who directed the show, really directed the hell out of the special. And so he made it really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you did differently for the filmed version
we really just try to capture what the live experience is and
mm-hmm.
as much as we can.
Yeah. Your last special that was on Netflix, Thank God for Jokes, which I just rewatched actually.
Oh, cool.
And holds up incredibly well, especially considering it was filmed like, what, 3 or 4 days before the 2016 election.
Oh God, yeah.
Does that feel like a different time that you were filming that special? Does it feel like a long time ago?
Yeah, it did. It was very, it's funny because when people ask me about the state of jokes and everything right now, because mm-hmm. it's a very
popular topic.
I'm always like, well, I did a special about that. It's on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
It came out long before this mm-hmm. was the hottest topic in America.
Yeah.
And it's my thesis.
Which part of it is your thesis? Or how would you describe the thesis?
Well, I think that it's sort of what I say in the end, in that final monologue, where I say that the world is getting smaller, which is, of course, becoming, oh my gosh, if you are following current events now, your fucking head will explode thinking about how much the world is getting smaller. And it's going to become only more and more tense because people have such starkly different ideologies and feelings about things. And I think that, you know, one step towards a better understanding of things is for us to listen to other people in the context in which they intend their words.
Mm-hmm. That special did feel more like in a traditional stand-up special in some ways compared to...
And that's how
to,
it started.
Yeah.
Yeah, what happened was is I went on the road. It's related to this in a certain way. Jen didn't want me to talk about our pregnant life and having a child on stage.
Really?
And that was like the first time in our whole relationship where... And we had talked about that. Like I say in the show, I was like, I was very clear.
Yeah.
I never want to have a kid. I was, similarly, like I was very clear that I'm going to talk about us, you know, my life on stage, and that's us. And
you've set a precedent that that your life and your relationship is going to get
talked about. It's going to be in there, yeah, because it's just what I do. And then like, and then she didn't want me to do that anymore. And then so that I wrote Thank God for Jokes, which is really not a... It's just about jokes.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, and she's in it. I mean, there's like Catsachusetts and things like that. But yeah, it's mostly about like the idea of jokes and how jokes ultimately, I mean, there's the other line you're saying, like, what is the thesis? Like the other line that you pull out of it is like all jokes have to be about something, which I think is a truism.
Yeah.
That, and there's a line that never made it into the show because I felt like it was too on the nose, but I feel like is relevant to the conversation now, which is people have the right to tell jokes and people equally have the right to be offended by jokes.
Yeah, that's a big...
those two ideas can coexist. And it was too on the nose to say that in the show because it would sound... It would tip into TED Talk.
Yeah.
The special. And you know what I mean?
Sort of like a lecture.
Or a lecture. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's not what I wanted to do.
Yeah. But I do. I mean, there is this thing now. Comedians get very upset. A lot of comedians seem to be getting very upset when they're criticized.
Yeah. It's a wild thing.
But I mean, it seems like what you're saying is that you do feel like the criticism can be fair. I mean, there's such a thing as fair criticism of comedy.
Well, there's criticism of everything.
Basically,
if you're being criticized, it means that you're charting culturally.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's people think it's relevant.
Yeah. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. If people think what you're saying is relevant, then some people say, I like what you're saying. Some people are going to say, I hate what you're saying. But I think that what's been hard for a certain generation of comedians, perhaps, is that comedy used to be more under the radar.
Right.
Like it didn't chart.
Mm-hmm.
Like it didn't, it was like kind of like, I wouldn't say it was subculture, but it was sort of like not zeitgeisty.
Yeah. Is that how it felt when you started?
Yeah. In the 90s, like I started in the late 90s. I worked the door at the Washington, D.C. Improv and was like, yeah, like it didn't feel like anyone was getting into comedy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, whereas now it feels like it's everybody's getting into comedy. Like it's...
Yeah, and comedy's kind of the biggest thing.
Yeah, I take an improv class and I do, you know, like I'm into that. I'm a comedian too. And you're like anybody, like it feels, I feel like I have that conversation three times a day, which isn't to say that those people aren't great comedians and aren't going to be great comedians. It just means that there's more of them.
Coming up, Mike explains why he never felt like it was a big risk to move from traditional stand-up comedy clubs to one-man theater shows. He didn't have that much to lose. This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Skylight Frame. The holidays are just around the corner. How's your holiday shopping going? I know it's not always easy to find the perfect gift for the people in your life. That's why I want you to check out Skylight Frame. Skylight Frame is a photo frame you can update instantly by email from anywhere. Sending photos to Skylight is effortless. Everyone in the family can just email them to your personal Skylight email address and they'll pop up in seconds. It's great for keeping the family close and connected, especially with those who live far away. It has a black frame and white mat, so it looks like a real photo frame that adds a beautiful touch to your home. Skylight Frame has a gorgeous 10-inch touchscreen. You can swipe through photos with your finger and even tap to thank the person who sent the photo. And it's 100% satisfaction guaranteed. If you don't love your Skylight, they'll offer you a full refund. And you can preload it with your favorite photos for a personalized gift. Import pictures of you and the special person in your life that they didn't even know you had. Now, I've been saying for the last few weeks that I'm going to be getting my parents a Skylight Frame this holiday season, so it will definitely not be a surprise at this point, but I hope they like it anyway. And if you want to do the same, I have a discount code just for you. Now, as a special holiday offer, you can get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com and enter code LAUGH. That's right, to get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame, just go to skylightframe.com and enter code LAUGH. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com, promo code LAUGH. Yeah, so, I mean, let's talk a little bit about that, sort of how you started. So you went to Georgetown, right?
Yeah.
And then did you stayed in D.C. for a bit after, or did you...
I sort of was in between because my, my girlfriend at the time went to grad school in D.C., and so I moved up to New York. I was sort of like living on my sister's couch for a little bit, and I was on an air mattress in Queens. And then I was like back and forth to DC, and I was like driving my mom's station wagon around the country, and I was like really struggling. I was really like not doing well, and I wasn't a very good comic, and it was like, but I was very ambitious. I really like wanted it to happen. And
I mean, we see a lot of that in Sleepwalk With Me.
Sleepwalk With Me has a lot of that visually. And... yeah.
So is that Band-Aid part of the act? No, you're not the head wound comics, not your tag. You know, like, I got a head wound after every joke. Is that you?
No, look, I got to be honest with you. She wants me to do half hour. I only have like 10 minutes of material. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Really? Wow. You're going to have to fill out that time somehow, man. Do some crowd work, talk to the audience, make fun of people.
Whenever I make fun of people, they punch me.
Matt, we're bringing you on now.
Don't do that on stage.
Thanks.
Unless it's your closer.
Is that a pretty... Was it odd to kind of revisit the time when you weren't as good of a comedian and portray that on screen?
Yeah, it was a challenge, you know, because portraying comedy on screen is difficult because actually the trick of it is the jokes that are not funny... technically still have to be pretty funny.
It can't be that bad.
You know, yeah, so it's like, yeah. I say the joke in the movie, I forget what it's one of my first jokes when I started out. I was like, the thing about Cookie Monster is he doesn't really eat the cookies. Or like, do you think Cookie Monster has an eating disorder? Like, I forget what even the joke is, but it's not terrible. Like, like all things considered, like, it's like one of the jokes is like, I would hate to be a stick insect because everyone's all the other insects are always bumping into you. And you got to be like, you know, watch it. And they're like, you look like a stick. And you're like, I have eyes. And they're like, they were closed. I mean, it's not the best joke, but it's also not the worst joke.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know. Those are like jokes when I was starting out and I use them in the movie. But that's the thing about like, you know, performance movies, which I studied a lot when I was making that, is you have to show an arc of performance.
Yeah.
And so, but you have to have the bad performances be entertaining in some way too.
Yeah. You can't just totally turn off the audience with the, yeah.
So like a good example of that is, and it was sort of my model, was the movie Once.
Yeah.
Because it's like at the beginning, he's playing covers.
Mm-hmm.
But the covers are pretty good.
Yeah, and he's pretty good.
Yeah.
He sounds pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
He just hasn't found his, his sound
yet. And Marquetta is like, hey, you should play your own stuff.
Yeah.
And that's good too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the reveal.
Yeah.
But that movie really works. Like, I was sort of stealing that sort of model, which is like that my early stuff was okay, but it was like not really about me. And then as I went along, it was like more about me. And
yeah, I'm interested in that evolution from more, you know, pure joke stand up to, you know, these shows that you've been doing for a while now, which really have an arc, have emotional elements to them. How much I've assumed from hearing you talk about it that Ira Glass is a big part of that, and sort of about that in that transition that you
Ira
made.
Glass is a big part of that, and my director Seth Barish is a big part of that. My professor from college, is my screenwriting professor, John Glavin, was a big part of that too. Mm-hmm. He taught really interesting group of writers. He taught John Mulaney after me and Jacqueline Novak after me. He taught Jonah Nolan, who was in my class.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In Westworld, yeah.
Yeah, and co-wrote the Batman movies. Like Jordan Ardino, he's Brendan O'Brien, who wrote Neighbors. Like, he was pretty... Those are all people who, like, were in my span of, like, my decade.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, like, a lot of them working writers. Yeah. Now, and they're good, really good. But he... I think when I was 24, 25, I wrote a like a two-hander, one-act play, and it was called Baby on a Train. And because I thought I was going to be a playwright or a screenwriter,
that was sort of what you imagined for yourself.
That's what I thought. Yeah, yeah. Because I'd done 4 years of screenwriting and playwriting in school, and then my day job was like driving the station wagon around the country, kind of thing, and doing these MC spots at sort of small clubs. And. And then I put on this this one act play called Baby on a Train, and I think it's pretty good. It's a pretty good play. It's a sweet little play, but no one showed up for it. And there was like 14 people in the audience, and it was sad because we're here in Los Angeles, which I've never done well in Los Angeles because I feel like it's just not a good town for me.
Yeah.
In terms of the show business side of it, because I take people at their word.
Big mistake.
Yeah, that's a huge mistake. So this town is filled with people, and they're like, "You're wonderful," and then I'm like, "Thanks." And then they're like, and then you call them the next day, and that you never hear from them again. Yeah. You know, and you're like, and so I had like a manager at the time, which I think is just an obsolete profession at this point. I think so. Yeah, I don't have a manager.
Yeah,
but it's a big profession. I mean, people make a lot of money. Yeah, there's a lot of fancy cars driving around town with managers on them. And but this manager I had was like, he read the play. He was like, if you mount this play yourself, I'm gonna pack that room with industry. And I did it.
And you took him at his word.
Yeah, I took him at his word. I thought he liked the play.
Yeah.
He said he liked the play. sorry, I'm coughing, but so let me just make sure the fluids, they're coming soon.
Yeah.
But so I mounted that play. It was a bomb. I called my writing professor from college and I sort of told him that, and he goes, "You know, you should really just write a solo play." I go, ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, that was a big moment.
Yeah. Well, and so then I just went to TKTS and I just sort of saw whatever I was on Broadway and off Broadway.
Solo shows?
Saw everything.
Mm-hmm.
I Am My Own Wife, Bridge and Tunnel, The Tricky Part. And The Tricky Part was my favorite one. It was directed by Seth Barish, who directed my four shows now.
Mm-hmm.
I approached him and I said, I wrote this show called Sleepwalk With Me, and, you know, and I think we got it off Broadway maybe 5 or 6 years later. Like, it took years. It
took a long time.
That's the thing that is, it's hard to tell people who are aspiring solo performers, is like, Eugene Merman has this great line. He goes, when people ask for advice as a comedian, he says, start doing it, keep doing it, call me in 10 years. And it's like,
it's kind of true.
It's kind of true. Like, it just takes years.
Yeah. Did you have any concerns about kind of moving away from traditional quote-unquote stand-up and embracing theater, or how did you...
I didn't have concerns about it because things weren't going well enough for me to have concerns.
Right, yeah. there is this kind of like macho stand-up thing that's
It's
like the clubs and it's hilarious. Maybe it's kind of gone away a little bit. I don't know if you feel like it's still there, but
that was a big thing with Hannah Gadsby's special where people were like, it's not stand-up, it's a one person show. It's like, it doesn't matter what it is. It's beautiful.
Did you feel like you related to her in those moments
when
people were criticizing it?
Of course. Yeah. It doesn't matter what you call anything.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. You could go to a play and it could be 3 hours long and there's not a single word of dialogue and someone goes, well, that wasn't a play. It was experiential theater.
Yeah.
You know, you go, yeah, okay. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's called bubble wrap.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it just matters ultimately, like, what the experience is for the audience member.
Yeah.
When I saw Hannah Gadsby's show, I was like, whoa. I saw it downtown before it became like an international phenomenon. I saw it at Soho Theater, and which is this small little space in New York, and I sent like 10 comedians to go see it.
Yeah.
I was like, I bought tickets for like all these younger comedians, including Jacqueline Novak, who I ended up producing.
I love her show.
Oh, it's incredible.
I got to see it here before she went to New York.
It's just the best. She's a phenom.
Yeah.
And so I sent a bunch of, there was, I was doing a storytelling show. I was producing a storytelling show for one night at Union Hall called The Whole Story. Mm-hmm. And it was like Gary Richardson and Sam Jay, Jacqueline Novak, Chris Laker, Josh Rabinowitz, Kevin Barnett, who passed away.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. It was like a really special night. And I sent those guys all to see Hannah's show. Cause I was like, there's no other way I can explain this.
You just have to see it.
Yes.
Yeah. And what did they think, or what kind of responses did you get?
It was mixed.
Yeah.
But that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Mixed reaction is great. Like, some people loved it. Some people didn't like it. It was, but it's all part of that. It was all part of it. What we were just saying before, which is when something becomes popular, not everyone's going to like it.
Yeah.
Some people, yeah.
And you don't care if you're called stand-up or called theater.
It doesn't matter. Well, it's so funny because people are... when that special came out, some people were tweeting like, how come when Mike Birbiglia... in the debate of whether hers is stand-up.
Yeah.
How come when Mike Birbiglia does it, that's no one complains about that? And I was laughing because I was like, Hannah Gadsby is so much bigger than I am. She is like an international phenomenon. Like it's not even close. And they do complain about it to me. Like, I get tons of flack. You're not a stand-up. You're a blah, blah, blah. All right. Whatever you fuck. I don't care.
Yeah.
Her new show is great, too.
Yeah,
I don't even know if they filmed it or what, but I saw it live.
It's supposed to be on Netflix or somewhere.
It's tremendous.
And then I think it's going to be in L.A. in February, so I'm hoping to see it then.
I think she's really good. She's really great for comedy in general because it opens people's aperture to what comedy can be.
Yeah.
So even if some person doesn't like it or some person loves it, there's one person watching that who's going, oh my God, it can be that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a great outcome.
Yeah. Since I brought him up and we didn't really talk about it, I did want to touch on your relationship with Ira Glass and This American Life, because I think it was probably the first time that I heard you, and probably a lot of people
maybe
heard you.
How did that
first start, and what do you feel like it's meant for your career?
It started because of my relationship with the Moth storytelling series. This was before the Moth was a radio show, actually, and I had done a few stories with the Moth, which is a great organization, and I just, at a certain point, I think I said to Catherine Burns, who's the artistic director, like, would you be willing to send this sleepwalking story that I recorded for the Moth to This American Life? Because I feel like I've always thought I'd be a great fit with that. Mm-hmm. Because all these years, like when I would listen to David Sedaris on This American Life, I was like, I think I'm more like that.
Yeah.
Than
like these stand-ups that you're seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always related to it. Like, I always thought like that was always felt like he was a kindred spirit comedically. And so I was like, oh, I thought that'd be a great fit. And then eventually the moth, Catherine, sent it over there. And then I was up on their board, like as a 3x5 note card for a while. I was a possible for like a while. I think for like a year.
I'm sure they have a lot of possibles.
Yeah. Yeah. They get pitched constantly.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, Julie Snyder, who the senior producer, called me and she goes, we'd like to run it, the audio from The Moth. And I go, you know, I'd really like to do the story like Sedaris does, where he's in the studio. And she was like, no, we're not going to do that.
That's too much work.
I had some resistance to it. And I understood why they had some resistance. I had resistance to that, to the live version. And then Ira just called me, which is a crazy celebrity phone call.
Because the voice
is the part.
Yeah, I'd probably freak out if Ira Glass called me on the phone.
It's a crazy experience. And so he's like, this Ira Glass. I'm like, oh, you know, you just feel like you're talking to the radio.
You feel like you're on the radio.
On the radio. Yeah. And he was like, here's why I think you should do it. Here's why I think you should do the live audio. And he was right. And I wake up and I'm falling off the top of our bookcase in our living room. And I land on the floor hard on top of our TiVo. And it broke into pieces, and I'm disoriented on the floor, and it's like one of these stories where people black out drinking and they wake up in Idaho and they don't know where they are and they're like, oh no. Hardee's, you know, or whatever's there. But it was in my own living room. I was just like, oh no. TiVo pieces, and
I ended up like meeting up with him in New York, and then we've ended up doing two movies together and this show together, a new one, and probably like 10 plus, you know, stories for his radio show. And it's just been like amazing. I mean, he's just been a great mentor.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Don't Think Twice as well, just because I really, really love that film.
Thanks.
When I saw it, it's one of those movies where, I don't know if you've had this experience of seeing something and feeling like, I'm pretty sure this was made for me.
That's what, you know, it's so funny. I was talking to Kevin Nealon the other day. I did his hiking show.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, you know, it's funny. He goes, I really like Don't Think Twice. And by the way, I love it when SNL
people like
alums
it.
Like it.
Because it's, it could be.
Because it's their existence, right? And in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it means you like got part of it right in some ways.
Yeah.
Like you feel like, okay, good. And he goes, whenever I tell people to watch that movie, he goes, it must be like 10 people who I've said that to, and they go, he stole that idea from me. And it's, one of my friends, Joe, she goes, she has a saying about the movie, which is, you're so vain, you probably think Don't Think Twice is about you. Because it is one of those, there's a lot of people who are like, that's my exact story, you know?
It kind of is Chris Gethard's story, though.
yeah, that's true. He was opening for me when I wrote it.
Yeah.
So we were living on tour bus together. Mike Berkowitz, my agent, we have this way of looking at that period of my life and Chris's life, because he represents Chris too, which is like I helped him with Career Suicide, and he helped me with Don't Think Twice, because Career Suicide was literally like me and him up late on the bus, and he told me that story.
Yeah, I've heard him tell the story.
I go, that's
about
yours,
talking to
you know.
Yeah.
That's the show, man.
Yeah.
That's, you want to be a stand-up? Too, that's your show, you know? And he was like, this is not funny.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
Yes, it is.
Trust me. Yeah, you were right.
And but then inversely, he helped me understand the improv journey.
Yeah.
In this way, that was
And the experience amazing. And the whole Saturday Night Live experience of not getting it. I mean, you never auditioned for Saturday Night Live, right?
No, I didn't even. Not only did I not audition for it, I didn't get to audition for it. I mean, that's how low my career was at that period. Mm-hmm. In that period of time. I think my agent at the time like sent a tape and it would no one ever responded kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like I didn't even show up to the whatever studio.
Do you, I mean, I have a kind of unhealthy, weird obsession with Saturday Night Live.
Oh yeah, me
do
too.
You, yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, you could tell from watching the movie.
Oh, I'm obsessed with it. Yeah. I love Saturday Night Live and, I've just loved it since I was a kid and, you know, I think there's a line akin to this in the movie, but it's a little bit for comedy nerds. It's like sports for us.
I'm glad you're keeping score.
It's
you know
the sports
I mean?
Of comedy. It's the only live sporting event of comedy.
But comedy sports. Isn't a sport. Comedy. It shouldn't have winners and losers, and there shouldn't be points.
They don't have, I mean, they got Gary Cho, and then it's like, who else? You know what I mean? Everybody else is
white.
Even if it wasn't me, there should be somebody else on this show that represents another
different shades of white. Certainly, mm-hmm.
Yes, there's definitely they've got eggshell,
to ecru,
to off white, to almost ochre.
I enjoy ochre performers. Yeah.
It was good when I was little.
Right. You never know if it was good when you were little or you were just little so you didn't know. It's the great paradox of Weekend Live is, was it good ever?
And can I,
or did we just think
really,
so because no, we were 12?
You should not have said that in your audition. I think that's
right. It's live. It's on television every week. It's consistent, you know. It,
there's kind of like there's like a draft kind of aspect
yep,
to it.
Yep, there's a draft. That's right. There's, you know, and then...
Rookie players, yeah.
And there's a seasonal aspect to it, too, you know. There's a holiday aspect to it, you know. They do. It's always something special around Christmas. And
Eddie Murphy this year.
That's right. Yeah, I saw that. And then it's like, I don't know, man. It's just like there's something about that show, you know. And then it's similar to sports. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's bad. Sometimes it's okay. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes they win. Sometimes they lose.
I do like how your character in the movie says something like, "Was it ever good?"
I think Seth Meyers like put it well once when he said like one thing is always true about every episode of Saturday Night Live, like some of the sketches are good, some of the sketches are bad, some of the sketches are okay.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's like and that's sort
it's
of
just
great.
The reality of what it is.
I don't know, there's something about it.
But it's just endlessly fascinating somehow
it is.
At
it's
the same
endlessly
time.
Endlessly fascinating.
I know you joked, I think with him on his show, Seth, about being worried that you were going to get sued.
Oh, I thought that they very well might sue us. And then at a certain point, like our distributor was like, no, it'd be good if they sued us.
Yeah.
It'd be good. The same way that like Al Franken got sued by Fox News or something. And it was like, it made the book go
sales,
to number one or something like that.
So you were kind of hoping that maybe.
But I wasn't really. I mean, the idea, I'm too neurotic to want to be sued.
Right. Yeah.
No matter who says.
Did you ever, I mean, I guess you've talked to, you know, people like Kevin Nealon and Seth, but did you ever hear from that Lorne Michaels had any awareness of it or
no, but then like people will always say to me like in the inner circle, they'll be like, yeah, everybody knows about it.
How could you not?
Yeah. You know, I know Seth and I know Fallon and it was in some ways a weird movie to make because it's like you're a little bit of a narc by making the movie.
Yeah.
Because your community.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, yeah.
You're calling out this reality that maybe is more people don't talk about out loud.
Yeah, and then you're like admitting a certain thing about yourself, which is like envy.
Right.
You know, like it's, you know, not.
I mean, your character is.
My character's
pretty,
miserable. Yeah, my character's miserable.
That was it is striking to see because, you know, I think it's a level beyond the character that you play.
It's not me
on stage,
at
you know?
All. Yeah. It's nothing like me, really.
Yeah. And it's pretty dark.
It's a dark character. Yeah.
Yeah. Was that fun or was that
scary? Yeah. I like playing characters that are, you know, outside of myself because it's like no one's going to cast me as that.
So you just cast yourself.
Yeah. I directed it. Yeah. I can say I play that part. And people, it was funny because my friend Yorma, who wrote for SNL, Yorma Taccone, he for years in Lonely Island.
Yeah.
we were doing readings at my house, and he was like, "Well, you have to play Jack." That was the Keegan part. And he's like, "You gotta," you know. I was like, "No."
Yeah,
I can't play Jack.
Yeah,
because he gets cast on Saturday Night Live.
You have to believe that he gets cast.
There's a reason I was never cast in Saturday Night Live. I'm not talented in that way. And so why the hell would my, as an actor, it's that thing when you see a movie and you're like, you're not good enough to be that.
Yeah.
And it fucks up the experience. So like
Keegan-Michael Key is like totally believable as a Saturday Night Live.
Not only is he believable, I mean, he would have been one of the greats if he was on it. I mean, Key and Peele is one of the best sketch comedy shows of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love the movie, and it did speak to me.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix now. People want to see it. It's had a nice like
second
tale.
Life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think there'll be a film version of the new one? and follow up, will Paul Rudd play?
God, that was the funniest thing. I feel bad because I've been goofing around about that on social media about that review, because the Charles McNulty wrote in the Times, and he's a really good reviewer and he's a really good writer. That if the new one is a movie, Paul Rudd must star. And I'm just like, that just sums up my entire Hollywood experience.
It's
that
so
you
funny.
Show up and you go, "Hey, I'm here." And they're like, "Okay, so you know who'd be great at this is Johnny Depp."
Coming up, how Mike convinced Terry Gross to play herself in his hilarious short film, Fresh Air 2, Too Fresh, Too Furious. So what I want to do now, as we sort of get towards the end here, is run through some of the stuff in your career that we didn't get to talk about yet. And see if there's kind of a quick memory or story that jumps out to you. So starting with your late night stand-up debut, which was it on Letterman?
Yeah, 2002. Yeah.
What do you remember about that night?
What I remember is that I was in utter disbelief that it was happening.
Yeah.
And that they asked me if I wanted cue cards with bullet points of my jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No, I don't think I need that." And then my brother Joe was there, who's been writing with me for years and producing with me. And he goes, "Yeah, we'll do the cue cards." And then I get out there. I get out there and my mind goes totally blank. And I look at the cue card and I can see my next joke. And it saved me.
Yeah. Did you look at it after that first time? Did you keep looking at it?
No, it was just I did the first joke and then I went blank, and then I looked at the second one, and then I think I was okay from there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Did you get to meet Letterman?
No.
He's pretty separate from everything.
Yeah, it's amazing how separate he is from comedians on that show. But he's just an eccentric. He's an self-described eccentric person.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about your scene in Girls.
Yeah.
Which episode entitled
The Vagina Panic.
Yeah, the excruciating scene with Lena Dunham.
Yeah.
The awkwardness.
This is really... Where did you go to school?
Oh, I went to Syracuse upstate.
I have so many friends who went there.
Yeah, me too.
Because you went there with them.
Yeah, a few of them up there.
I read a statistic that said Syracuse has the highest incidence of date rape of any university.
Wow.
Which weirdly went way down the year that you graduated. That was just a joke, because I was saying that there was no more date rape because they figured out who it was, who was doing it, and it was you.
Maybe you're not used to office environments like this, but jokes about rape or race or incest or any of that kind of stuff, it's not office okay. And so I just don't think this is gonna work out right now, but call us back maybe 6 months, 8 months down the road, and we'll stay in touch.
What do you remember about filming that?
Loved shooting that scene. Jody Lee Lipes, filmed it. Lena directed it. We improvised a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was a unique scene for that show because they weren't improvising around that time on the show a lot. And so, but Lena and I were friends, and she goes, "Hey, do you want to play this part?" And I was like, "Yeah, yeah." And and she and I just had good rapport, and so we thought like that would be sort of what made the scene work,
mm-hmm.
and what would make it painful.
Yeah,
when it turned, yeah. like how it's so essentially painful. It's similar to Don't Think Twice. How well it goes is how poorly it yeah. becomes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So now I have to ask about what I think is my favorite thing that you've ever done, which is Fresh Air 2, Too Furious.
Yeah.
With Terry Gross.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it.
It's just, I also rewatched that recently and just, I was laughing out loud by myself. But
I'm so glad you like it. I feel like it didn't go, not only did it not go viral the way that one would hope mm-hmm. a short film like that
yeah.
does, it didn't even go bacterial. Like it didn't even, like it didn't,
what was the story?
It didn't get a cold, so it didn't catch a cold.
I was trying to remember because it was part of a live, yeah. was it part of a live
it
show?
It actually was part of a This American Life Cinema
which I think
event.
I was at.
Okay.
And that's where I saw it. And then.
Yeah, on the big screen, it's phenomenal because yeah. we shot it on Super 16 and Joe Anderson filmed it, my cinematographer from Don't Think Twice, and so it looks really pretty. Yeah.
So how did you, so you were doing it for This American Life live show. Was it difficult to convince her to do that, or what was that process
A lot
like?
Of it was, I called Ira, and he asked, he goes, "Do you have anything visual?"
He's like, "I don't do visual."
yeah. He was doing a cinema live event. "Do you have anything visual?" And then I go, "What about this premise?" I got to give Ira a lot of credit for this because he's so good. There's so many things that he's great at, yes anding, mm-hmm. and this is one of them. I go, what if the premise is like I go and I'm being interviewed by Terry Gross, and then like it ends, and then I'm just like, "Hey, so we're like, what are you doing now?" You know? And then we'd like go to a cafe, and I'm like, "What are you doing now?" You know? And then he goes, And then Ira goes, "But it's got to go somewhere crazy. Like, you guys have to like rob a bank." And I was like, "Yeah, great idea."
Yeah.
And so that
that's what happens.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Wow. What happened?
Oh, Terry. I'm so sorry. I shot the guard by accident. And then I shot myself by accident.
Well, what does it feel like to be shot?
It's pretty bad, Terry. I don't think I'm gonna make it.
Well, Mike Birbiglia, thank you so much for joining us on this bank heist.
Thank you, Terry.
It's so good.
Yeah, my parents don't like it because it has a gun in it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you get shot. You shoot yourself.
They right, don't like that that's part of it too. Oh my God! Can you imagine? Probably, yeah. That never even occurred to me.
Yeah, that they wouldn't like seeing that.
That they wouldn't like seeing their child be shot. Yeah, they might not like that.
It's great though. I loved your performance in Trainwreck.
Thanks. I'm proud of that. Actually, which I think is, no one talks really, about it that
it's
much.
Kind
but
of a
I am
deep,
proud of it.
Deep performance, and there's a lot of great performances in that movie. Colin Quinn also really good. But did that feel like a different kind of acting challenge experience for you, or was that?
My wife has a beautiful poem that this winter. So Jen and I have a book coming out. It's the new one, Painfully True Stories from a Reluctant Dad with Poems by J. Hope Stein.
Mm-hmm.
And this winter, we were workshopping some of the stories with poems together.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on Judd Apatow's show at Largo.
Mm-hmm.
And we just were like, "What if we went up together and just did this thing back to back?"
Yeah.
And she read this poem that we explained to the audience. It was like a one of a kind, and now it's a two of a kind because we're saying it to you here. And she said, "I'm going to butcher the line, but the poem says something to the effect of, you say you don't want to be a father, but this director, he sees something in you."
Mm.
That you would be a good dad.
Yeah.
And it was like Judd Apatow cast me as a dad before my life did.
That's great.
And it's sweet. It's really sweet. And it is. Yeah. It was. Yeah. He cast me as a dad. And then there's also a funny thing, which is like Brie Larson as Brie Larson's husband, which is like in like this long string of like being married or in a fake movie TV relationship with women who are way out of my league.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a scene with Reese Witherspoon.
Oh yeah.
In Hot Pursuit, I was in. I feel a lot of things. Asia Kate Dillon and Billions.
Yeah.
There's a great many like semi-romantic things that I've been in.
Yeah. And it's kind of a Judd Apatow special too.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And then we had a son, Evan.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a dad. The funny thing about that experience was that Amy would improvise a lot on the set.
Yeah.
And man, is Amy Schumer a great improviser. Just incredible. And her character hated my character, mm-hmm. you know, because I was seen as like sort of the guy who, you know, her sister settled for me
yeah.
in some way. And so she would improvise all these insults of me mm-hmm. all day being like a loser. But I was like, it's me basically playing me. Like it's not, it's quote unquote Tom, but mm-hmm. it's pretty much Mike Birbiglia.
Yeah.
And so like I'd come home and say to Jen, like, I think that I might be a loser, you know? You know, like the joke that I would make on stage at the time, I remember this, I don't tell it anymore, but on the tour, on the train wreck tours, I would go, I'd come home to my wife and I'd say, I think I might be a boring loser. And Jen would say, you're not boring. It's goofy. But that was a very fond memory, and it was like a great cast. Like it had Brie Larson and Vanessa Bayer, and then we mm-hmm. went on that tour.
Yeah.
We went on this crazy whirlwind tour mm-hmm. of New York and LA, and it was Chicago. It was crazy, because it was like, it was actually, I lived in proximity or within the tsunami that was Amy Schumer exploding into the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that was cool.
Yeah.
That was a cool thing to be a part of.
And it's what brought Judd back to stand-up.
It brought Judd back to stand up too. Yep. Yeah.
So let's end with this. When you look back at all the stuff that you've done and people you've worked with, who do you feel like has been the funniest person just to be around that you've worked with on the set or in clubs or just who comes to mind?
The person that comes to mind like immediately, and it's a little obvious, but for me it's personal because we've been friends so long, is like John Mulaney.
Because mm-hmm.
like when early in my career, he got out of college, he came on tour with me when I came out with Two Drink Mike, and so we'd spend like hours and hours together on like a tour bus together. And he, it's like if you think he's funny on stage, like off stage he's like even funnier somehow. And he's uncannily like, it's kind of amazing that John wasn't a cast member on SNL.
Yeah.
Because, and around the time, I think we all thought, his group of friends were like, okay, he's a writer on it. Of course he'll be on it.
Yeah.
And then he never was.
Not because he didn't want to be.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But he, because he does so many voices mm-hmm. and impressions.
Yeah.
And like, he really is like a jukebox. Mm-hmm. Like he's the other person who is similarly hilarious is Bill Hader.
Yeah.
The two of them, and it's no surprise that they team up on things. Like the two of them are a riot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, great. So
and then my and then my daughter.
Yeah. Just throw that in there too.
My daughter Una. No, I do. I laugh the hardest when I'm with. I laugh the hardest when I'm with my wife and my daughter, and that's sort of like, I posted a photo on Instagram today of like a photo, because it was like a rare photo I had. Someone shot it for Netflix, where I'm like, oh, this is what my laugh looks like when I'm with my family.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd never capture that on film usually.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good luck with the show tonight and the rest of the weekend, and then Netflix and on to the next thing.
Apparently, yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It means a lot to me.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Mike Birbiglia for being on today's show, and to everyone at the Amundsen Theater in downtown LA for letting us record this episode backstage. The new one is now streaming on Netflix, and you can watch an exclusive clip from the special on thedailybeast.com. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!